So, my dad and I, we work together, which is wonderful. And about 2 years ago, we needed some plywood, a few truckloads of plywood, and it was in the middle of this whole commodity shortage and all that stuff. And we heard of this warehouse that was full of plywood, just like a ripe peach waiting to be plucked. And available to an enterprising person who could make a deal on it. So we drove there and we went and we got to this warehouse and it was mind-boggling. I'm gonna say I didn't me ever measure the building, but I'm gonna say it was at least 400 feet wide and probably 1,000 feet long. It was just and it was low, kind of low. The ceilings were 20 feet, but it felt low in that big building. All built of wood. It was an old tobacco barn, and it was full, floor to ceiling. At least a big area of it was full of lumber, plywood, MDF, veneer. To make a long story short, somehow or other, we ended up with all of this wood. And when I walked in there with my dad the first time, my dad, you have to know him, he's amazing, but he's a deal maker. And we get to this warehouse, and I said, "Dad, let's turn around and leave right now. Because if we don't, we are going to be saddled with this whole thing." Which kind of brings me to my next point here. Do any of you know where I could sell a lot of veneer? Really, truly, like rosewood veneer. Or mahogany veneer. Unbelievably beautiful stuff, but millions of feet of it, right? I'm not joking. And not just every guy on the street needs the veneer, I've found out. Anyway, get back to me on that. That would be really helpful. Well, and I was like, so why? And this lady who owns all of this stuff is this little old lady, 50 years old. With a terrible smoking problem, can barely move in a little Chrysler minivan. Who wants to sell her lumber? How did you? And she said, well, she was married to this man named Robin Jackson. And then we heard story after story about this Robin Jackson, this amazing man, this special forces man who ended up in Costa Rica, down there on some mission for the government, and he logged, and he had a little sawmill, and then he after he left the whatever force he was part of, he went back down there and started this little import-export lumber business, and it turned into an unbelievable wood import-export business in America. Over the course of his life, he was one of the biggest suppliers of wood and from China. He supplied Lowe's and Home Depot, and he just amazing. And this warehouse, this tiny little warehouse, was where all his extras went when he bought 100 container loads of half-inch mahogany plywood from China. If there was one container load left over, it went into this building. But then he got dementia and he died. The legacy of this incredible, I never met Robin Jackson, but I feel like I've been working with his stuff for a long time. The legacy of his life is kind of heartbreaking. Estranged from his wife, no family, no. Robin Jackson played an amazing game. He did an amazing job with the cards he was given, say, but then he died, and it was all—I mean, the vultures picked the carcass clean. The wife was miserable. There's no legacy of good, of lasting value, given by Robin Jackson, because he didn't look far enough ahead. Right? He lived this life. And he lived this life in a way he didn't even look. I don't think he even looked into his old age. He looked for a happy now. And his old age came and it was miserable. And then he died, right? And eternity. He hadn't prepared for eternity. We are surrounded by Robin Jacksons. And I have seen many, many teachers who play the wrong game. Play the short game, play the now game, the how I am feeling game, the what I deserve game. We're lazy sometimes. No, I don't have time to pray for all those students. No, I don't have time to... You know what? I have to have a life myself. We're arrogant. Who do you think you are coming here to talk to me like that? Stupid mom. Under our breath, obviously. We're selfish. Quit bothering me. Don't you see I'm busy? We play the game in front of us. And because we are looking at ourselves, I think, and the things that make us happy, we play the short game. Now, we talked about being like a lily, considering the lilies. But remember that today leads to forever. This day that you are teaching is leading you to forever. And the game we play today is actually all about forever. Everything about the things we do today affect eternity. So I have some stories that I want to tell you to help us recognize the opportunities to play the long game, the eternity game, and give us the courage and the tools to play it well. And so a few years ago, this is about a way of thinking, I think. A few years ago, I was in Bangladesh for some little interpreting trip. We went and had some church meetings, and we were done. One of my friends said, would you like to go with me and see the palace of the king? And I said, well, yeah, that would be fun. I enjoy the palace. I would love to see the palace of the king. And so we got on this little van, and we did a little bike thing, and we went and got to this palace. And it looked to me exactly like an empty field. And my friend was there, and he's like, yeah, this is not actually the palace. This is where it used to be. I mean, long ago there was a palace here. And so we sat there, and we looked at it, and it was just a field, really. But there had been a palace, and that was worth something. And he said, yeah, there's really nothing left of the palace because they hauled off all the bricks to build houses with. And he said, but the bathtub is still left. Oh, okay, well, can we see that? Oh, yeah, we can look at the bathtub. So we went across this field and down through some trees, and then we came to the bathtub. And it was actually probably double the size of this auditorium. It was sunken in the ground. It was about half full of water. It was lined with bricks. It was actually beautiful. It was a place where, you know, they washed everything in the palace. It was the great washing area of the palace. And when I saw that, all of a sudden I realized the mass, the immensity of this complex. This thing was acres, and then they showed me the boundaries of where this palace was. One of the Mughals built this, the Mongols, they call them Mughals, but the Mongols, when they came, they established these little governments along the way they built this palace. Oh, I don't know how many, 500 and some odd years ago. I don't know where. But the palace, there was nothing left, just this old bathtub. And I got a little piece of that, the brick of that bathtub, and I brought it home and then promptly lost it. But I thought about it. This temple, I mean this palace, massive, strong, powerful, everlasting. Imagine the people living in that day. They look at this complex and they're like, this is a forever thing, right? Today there's nothing. But you know what? The least of the servants, the little boys who scrubbed the steps of that bathtub or swept the floor, they're still alive. Their souls, the part of them that matters most, is still alive today and will forever be. And I look at this building and I think about it, and you know, it's made of concrete and steel and beams and dry. Like these things last, right? But when every atom of this building is no more, is ground to dust by time or burned, the littlest child that is running around here will still be here. You will still be. Your students, they walk into your classroom. These are eternal students. Their souls last forever. And I want, it seems like these souls, they surround us, they're everywhere, and the culture works to distract us from noticing them. And we think about important things. We think about legacies and buildings and businesses and success and all these things that will completely be gone, but these souls will remain. So that's something to keep in mind. The value of these souls and the opportunity of these souls. So after we were done with the palace of the king, my friend said, well, would you want to go and see an old temple? Yeah, I would love to. So we went to this down the road a little ways, and we came to this old temple. Now this part of it was still standing. This was old. This was very old. They didn't know quite how old it was, but probably 1,000 years before the palace was built, this temple was standing there. This is a whole country. And I'm looking at this temple, and we're walking around. And there's trees growing out of sections of the roof, gigantic baobab trees. And it's kind of crumbling, but there's one intact area there. And in that intact area, there's an altar. And it's there and kind of protected. And there's some writing of the great Hindu traditions around it. And there's this altar. And there's not many people there at the temple, but there's still some priests there. And I get this really strange feeling. This is a place of darkness. And I asked one of those priests, I said, what do you sacrifice on that altar? And he looked at me for a long time, and he's like, we don't sacrifice anymore. Okay, I said, what did you sacrifice on the altar? He said, well, they needed to be perfect, but we sacrificed children. And my heart kind of recoiled that, oh, that's sick. Oh, no, you didn't. No. But then I thought about it. Every heart has a God-sized hole in it. And maybe there's an altar in your heart that either God fills our heart completely, or we will sacrifice our children. Look around you in the culture surrounding us. There's not altars and burning children, but there are children being sacrificed. The altars and the broken lives, the hearts around us, worshiping idols of man's make. Maybe some of these idols we build ourselves, and we dress them up, and we pat them down, and we name them Jesus, but they're an idol because they're not the real Jesus. And we worship these things, and because our worship is wrong, directed in the wrong place, we lose our children. They're sacrificed. I don't know, the feeling that of the children, the massive amounts of children rushing past into the void. I don't know. We've got to get it right. We've got to get this right. And who reigns in your heart? That's really, that makes all the difference. God can heal everything, but without Him, it will be terrible, destructive. So we get done with this temple and the nightmare that is there, and we leave, and my friend says, would you like to see Asia's largest tree? Yeah, I like that. Sounds safe enough. Let's go to the tree. So we putz over there, and we come to this forest, and we're at the edge of the forest, and we stop, and we get out, and my friend is like, well, here we are. I'm looking around. I'm like, oh, I've seen some big trees in Bangladesh. There's nothing here, you know. Should we go into the forest? Is that where the tree is? And he says, no. He said, this is the tree. The forest is the tree. Okay. He said, look, all the trees are connected. And so this is a baobab tree, and they spread. They have long, flat lateral branches, and you know, maybe 15 or 20 feet away from the trunk of the parent tree. They'll shoot a root down from high up, maybe 15, 20 feet in the air. The root goes all the way down to the ground, lodges, drills into the ground, and that root gets thicker and thicker and thicker and thicker until it's a trunk. and then it keeps going and shoots more roots down, and it just spreads like that. Well, they've been logging off of this tree for years. The old father tree has been cut down probably hundreds of years ago, but it's still going. There's branches reaching over the road and dropping roots down and growing fast and getting bigger. And all I just thought, and I'm looking at this tree, and I'm like, that's the kingdom. That's the kingdom of heaven. Here comes the devil, and he cuts, and he hurts, and he destroys, and this church, there's problems, and there's this person, he fails, and they cart him off, but it's too late. It's already gone. It's going. The kingdom is growing. It's spreading. It's expanding, and it's unstoppable, right? And we can be a part of that. Right, that kingdom will go on. Christ said he'll build that kingdom here on this world. Be encouraged as a teacher. You're part of a kingdom that nothing can stop. Just be there. Be a part of that. And then we went on there on that tree. I saw the last thing there that day. But before I tell you about that, in Matthew 13, we have the parable of the sower. And an interesting parable. You know, we have this guy, and he's out there, and he has some seed, and he's spreading the seed. Do any of you, is there anything kind of odd about this story to any of you? Anything kind of strange come to mind? Like, if you'd gone to Lowe's and paid $75 for a 5-pound bag of grass seed and gave it to your son and said, go spread the grass seed on the yard, and he was doing what this guy did, would you probably reprimand him? Son, not on the road? Are you crazy? The driveway? Do you not understand the briar? There's the good ground, that's where you put the seed, right? But this guy, in Matthew, he's going everywhere. It's like he's out of control. It's just seed going everywhere. Why did Christ tell it that way? Why didn't he say the man went out and planted in the good ground? I don't know. There's so much depth to that parable, to that story, you could take a lifetime to unravel it. But I wonder if maybe we don't know what the good ground is. We don't know. You're a teacher. Morning comes up. Your students file into your classroom. You sing your song. This is the good ground time. And your songs, and you do a good job. You follow some of the things we've learned here about leading, singing, and you're good ground time right now. And the devotions, and you get up there, and it's good ground time, and you're planting the seed. This is good seed. But later on, here comes the lunch recess, and you're kind of tired and sweaty, and you're playing soccer, and those boys kind of ganged up on you and got a goal. And it was a little dirty, and something kind of rises up in you, and you come back inside, and these children keep pestering you because you're tired and you have a headache, and you know it's been a long day, and maybe that's the good ground time. Maybe that's the only good ground time you're going to get. Maybe that minute in the middle of your frustration when something kind of happens in your classroom and all the eyes of your students turn to look at you, what's he going to do? What's he going to do with that one? Maybe that's the good ground, right? We don't know when that is. That's why you're not told to look for the ground. You're told to sow the seed. You're given seed. You're filled to the brim with this seed, this God, this power, these stories, the God himself. Sow that seed all the time, every moment, every day. That's what you're called to do. So when I was there looking at this tree, I saw, this is the rainy season in Bangladesh, so it's raining all the time. It's hot, we're dripping wet. It's just, well, as I'm looking at the side of this tree, I see a mushroom, gigantic mushroom. Kind of one of those kind of shelf type mushrooms, and it quits raining a little bit. There's a little bit of light. It comes down, shines on the mushroom, and when the sunlight hits that mushroom, it starts to smoke. And I'm like, oh wow, that's, I didn't think it was quite that hot out here, but I went and looked, and it's a lot. It's coming out of the bottom of that mushroom, and there's enough of it that it's drifting through the trees. Like there's a lot of this smoke. It wasn't smoke. It was it was spores. The mushroom was ready, prepared. The sunlight hit it. It was an opportunity. Little breeze, releasing its spores. How can you have the little seeds, enough seeds to make the area hazy? millions and millions and millions of seeds looking for a place to live. Now, most of those seeds don't land. I mean, they all land, but most of them don't survive. Very few of them will go and find the right ground, the right tree, the right bit of dead bark that's just wet enough but not too wet to grow another mushroom. But it doesn't matter because there's so many. It'd be like that mushroom. You know, Jesus, he's walking down the road and he sees a field that's plowed up or whatever. And he's like, hey, the kingdom of God is like that field. There's a man out there sowing and he's sowing the seed. He's sitting at a well. A lady comes to draw water. He's like, hey, the kingdom of God. Would you be interested in living water? There's such a thing. You'll never thirst again. Or when there's a vineyard, and he said, you know what? There's a vine, and there are branches, and I am the vine, and you could be the branches. And I think that's the kind of thing, as you be so full of God and loving him and focused on him and given to him, that as you go through your day, everything is an opportunity to sow the seed. Our job is to sow the seed because we don't know where the good ground is. Now, we have another story in the Bible. There's a man, his name is Noah, and he's given a job, and it's a big job. And he's working along, and somebody probably said something that triggered this thought. What about year number 50 in this 120-year process of building the ark? He's working away. He gets up in the morning, 5 o'clock. Another day of work on this boat. No rain clouds in the sky. I wonder if he ever wondered, like, God, how is this boat going to float here on the mountaintop? I wondered if he ever wondered, God, how am I going to load the animals? It would have been tempting for him to say, you know what, God, we need to get some of these details straight. I'm not wasting my life. Let's looking into the future and thinking about all the things that could go wrong and might go wrong. It would have been pretty easy for me, if I would have been Noah, to be distracted from doing the work today. But he had a clear command, right? And he didn't let fear of the future or worry about the future derail him. And I think that's really powerful. You know, I, as a teacher, I look at my students and I think about them, and there they are, and I love them, and then their future. How? And this really hit me in Bangladesh. Most of my students are Muslim, and they go back to their families, and they get married at 14, and the girls do, and the boys, they turn into these hard and beastie Muslim men, a lot of them do. It's really hard to give them back to God and to trust him and to say, today, all I have is today. Do my absolute best today, because fear of the future keeps you from doing anything today. And remember, like Noah, you're building a boat, but you're a preacher of righteousness, right? That's your job. He kept building because he knew the flood was coming, right? We're preparing for a fire. The fire is coming. And it is better to do the small things that we know today than to get bogged down with impossible ideas and not work today, not to start. Another little story. There is a man in North Carolina, from North Carolina. North Carolina is kind of proud of this guy. He's an interesting guy. His last name was Waddle. So that's cool. And so Waddle, he was an officer in the Confederate Army back during the Civil War. And he was given this job of taking a warship purchased from England and sailing it down months and months around the tip of Argentina into the Pacific Ocean and shutting down the Union whaling fleet, because they're making way too much money on the whale oil. So he the war is going badly for the South at this point. He gets the ship. He's trying to lock up some assets from the North, right? He's trying to get that money himself. So he sails down. He sails around the tip of Argentina. He sails up into the North Sea off the coast, or not the North Sea, but up off the coast of Alaska. and starts looking for the big plumes of smoke that show where the whaling ships are cooking off the blubber. And he goes to the whaling ships, and he's a big man of war. I mean, these guys they have harpoons. They can't fight with him. So he just kind of sidles up beside him and says, "Would you like us to blow you out of the water? Would you like to surrender to the South?" And they all said, "Well, let's surrender." And this was back in the day of honorable words. And so the captain of the ship would sign some papers and say, "Yeah, I'm a Southern guy now, not a Northern guy," and let him go. Nobody was killed in this whole campaign. It was quite something. And then he would go on to the next whaling ship. Well, he's doing this for like a year and a half or something when one of the boats, another boat, comes into the sea, and he's caught, captured how many ships, and says, "Whale, it's difficult news, but we lost the war like 2 years ago." And Whale had been doing a great job for a lost cause, right? The war was lost, right? And so anyway, it's kind of interesting. He sneaked back to England, turned the ship back over to the English instead of letting those Yankees have it. And interesting story. I wonder, I have met teachers, I don't think any here, I really don't, but I have met teachers who are disillusioned, really disillusioned with God. And maybe with their church and with the people, they've found the wrong heroes, they've forgotten the right heroes, but they still tell me they have this passion for a good education, something to prepare my children for this world. I'm preparing them to live in this world. The world has lost the war, right? That's the wrong side. That's the wrong army. There's a winning side, right? And it's not that one. If we're not fighting for the side of eternity, for the side of God, for the side of His kingdom here on this earth, we're on the wrong side. We're fighting a lost war. And you can be an amazing teacher. You can be an amazing general. You can be an amazing ship's captain and be successful on the wrong side, right? Don't do that. So there's a little story in Genesis that just shakes me every time I read it. And God comes to this old man, this hero of mine, of all of us probably, and he says to him, "Old man, I want your son." And I can't imagine that. I can't imagine that. I have a little girl. I can't imagine that question coming, that command coming from God. And I don't know what Abraham thought. He's there in his tent or whatever he lived in. I don't know what wrestling went on with God that night. The tears, I don't know. These are the three things that I tend to do when I am given an impossible command by God. I know it's impossible. And so I tell God, "God, I can't do that. You never made that guy do that. He's just happy and doing his thing. He never, God, that's not fair. God, you know what? It'll never work anyway. It can't work. Besides, I'm too weak. I can never do that. God, it's not. In fact, God, you plain don't understand. Christians have been Christians for a long time and never had to do things like that." That's what we tell God. Or maybe we say things like this. "You know, I'm strong. I'm a good Mennonite. I've got a good relationship with God, great relationship with God. And God doesn't want us to be uncomfortable, does he?" No, he doesn't. He's a good God. He's love. God is love, isn't he? And this thing he's asking me to do is really, at the end, it's an unimportant detail. It's one of those things, yeah, you can if you want, but it's one of those optional ones. It's not that important. And besides, I can have a great relationship with God and not get all radical like that. I mean, God, are you serious? And ultimately, this impossible thing you're asking of me is not necessary. Right? Or we can tell God, yeah, God, it is impossible. It's completely impossible. I can't do it. I'm too weak. But God, you are strong. And you say you will be with me. And I believe you. And then we obey, right? We can't do the impossible things alone, so we better follow directions. If you don't know how to bake a cake, follow the recipe. And directions come in the form of commands. Why did David say, "Oh, how I love thy law"? Like, I have a hard time wrapping my mind around that. This law, how can the law be something you love? And you read Psalm 119, you're like, David, this is unbelievable love for this law. What if it's the law that sets us free? What if it's the law that gives us life? What if it's the law that when we follow these commands, it helps us do the impossible things? It helps us be successful. Then we do the next step in front of us. The next thing in line to complete the impossible task. You get up while it's still dark and there's little points of stars hanging there in the desert sky, and you wipe the tears off your old face. You saddle up your animals and you start walking toward the mountain. Where you're going to lose the thing you love the most, you think. And as we walk, only when we walk, will we see the power of God. The God that can take and redeem anything while we're walking. So in North Carolina, we have a problem. And it's been a problem for a while. It's the loggers. We were worried about this as loggers. We had this little bug we call, a moth, not a bug for all you science teachers. This moth that was destroying our forests. And it was called a gypsy moth. And the gypsy moth itself wasn't a problem. It was the babies it had that were a problem. These little grubs, they grew up and they loved to eat. They ate like absolute pigs. They climbed the trunks of trees, ate all the leaves off of them to the point that the trees died. And you could watch a gypsy moth infestation. It was like a very, very slow-moving wildfire destroying the forest. And people tried everything to destroy the gypsy moths. They sprayed, but it's really hard to destroy the gypsy moth babies because they're the same moth that they use over in Europe, in Asia, far Asia, to make silk. And these little gypsy moth babies, these little grubs up in the trees, they make these little silk cocoons and they live inside them and they go out and eat the stuff and then they come back inside. Really hard to kill them with insecticides because the silk is waterproof, more or less. And they tried everything. They tried chickens. How do we kill these? Well, then they came up with a really devious plan. So a gypsy moth's life cycle goes a little like this. The eggs hatch in the ground, and the little babies are born. They're tiny little grubs. They climb the trees. They start eating. They eat until the tree is destroyed. They're nice and fat. They drop back to the ground, burrow down in there, form this little chrysalis cocoon thing, and they're transformed into a moth. And when they hatch, this little gypsy moth, the males and the females, they only are going to live 3 days. They don't even have a mouth to eat, right? The females are born and they're full of eggs. They're big, they're fat, they're full of eggs, they're gigantic. They're so big they can't fly. They have wings, but they can't fly. And their only job is to burrow up out of the ground and start to walk as hard as they can walk. They're only living 3 days. And they're trying to spread away from all the dead trees, right? They need new trees. And they can make it about 300 yards before they die. Well, after about 300 yards, they dig a hole, in go the eggs, they die. Well, the males are born with a different job. They can fly. They're little and quick. And their only job in this life is to find the females. They wake up and they sniff. And the females are putting off a sweet pheromone that the males really, really like. And off they go. They find a female. They fertilize the eggs. And the life cycle goes on. Well, somebody thought, what happens if we make a smell just like the female moths, except better, stronger? So they got to work and they put together this fantastic pheromone copycat, and they soaked bran flakes or corn flakes or whatever little biodegradable flakes they had in this, and they waited until the moths were just about to hatch, and they took an airplane and they seeded the whole forest with these things. Well, so the females hatch, they don't know anything's different, and they start to walk. 300 yards later, they lay their eggs and die. Well, the males, they hatch and they sniff. And they fly to the sweetest smell. And not one of them goes to a female. 3 days later, everybody's dead, including the future generations. Not another moth hatches in that woods. One generation, they're destroyed. Right? So here we are. Here you are. Given a very important job, right? And we live a long time, right? I think in the big scheme of things, it's not much more than 3 days, right? It's really short. In eternity's eyes, it's a blink of an eye. And the devil's been spending millennia making copycats, a smell so sweet, it's hard to ignore. And we wake up, and sometimes we go to the loudest voice or the most clutching thing, the sweetest smell. And a generation dies. And it's different for everybody. That bran flake we're hanging on to that's going to destroy our future and the future of our offspring, the people we love, looks different for everybody. Your bran flake is probably different than mine. I'll tell you what my bran flake is, one of them. I probably have lots. But I'll tell it like this. I'll tell you a little story to illustrate it. So there was I like when people like me. That's a nice thing. Teachers, we like, I don't know, we like, when the child brings you the apple or the donut, and I prefer the donut, actually. And we like that, right? And the mom says, or the dad, you know, you did a great job. You made a difference in the boy's life. And that's a heady experience, a wonderful thing. But then sometimes that goes wrong, right? One time in my life that went wrong, and it's a long story, but turns out a lot of people didn't like me. Didn't like me, Mommy. They're not nice to me. And it really hurt, right? Actually, really hurt. It was more than just I don't like you. It was really painful. And I was, at risk of sounding kind of melodramatic, I was in the mountains in Colorado, and I was up there hiking in the night. It was very high, all by myself. And I'm hiking along, and I'm like, God, I know I'm your child, and I love you, and I'm at peace with you. There's nothing between me and you, God. But why do I hurt so much? Why am I crying? Because I hurt so much. Because these people that I loved and respected, and they turned on me. And it's kind of funny. I'm walking along, and there in the creek bed that I'm walking down, there's an altar. I don't know what else it could have been. It was a beautiful pile of stones, and there on the top of the altar was some wood laid out. Maybe beavers do that in Colorado. I have no idea. But there's an altar, and I'm standing there by this altar, and God says, you know, that part of you that's hurting right now, that you part of you, is supposed to be on the altar. It's supposed to be dead, right? And dead people don't feel pain, right? And I tried to put Aaron Durstein on that altar, and he hops back off every chance he gets. But there's that's true, right? Jesus promises if we give up that thing we love, that me, that self, that I want to be appreciated, that fear of men, that love, the praise of men, all this thing that boils down into the ego and the pride of Aaron, right? If we let that go, then he'll come live within you. He says it's not going to be you anymore. It's going to be me. The living, breathing, pulsating, glowing Christ himself will come and live within you and shine through every part of you. If you somehow put that bran flake on the altar and let it go. Anyway, we have only a few days to live. But the game we play is deadly serious. And if we get it wrong, we sacrifice our future. We don't have time to see the end of this game we are playing while we live. We have just enough time to play the part we have been given to play. This game we play is a war. It is a war where the winner takes everything. It is a war in which we must play some role. And it seems to me like it doesn't take a very special talent to look around us and see the brokenness that surrounds us in the world, in our churches, in the families of our students. It's pretty easy. I think of Elisha's servant there in wherever it was, the little town. And he's like, Elisha, you see the army out there? It's a big army. They don't like us, those people. They're mean people. But I think only the eyes of faith that have been opened by God can see the shining army that's on our side. An army that surrounds you, your classroom, your church, the people that you love. The mountains are covered. And it's unstoppable. Open your eyes. Seize the great gift that we call today. We may not have another. It is the great opportunity of your life. God bless you all.